Take a network break. Stuff your stockings with virtual donuts and settle in for your weekly dose of informed cynicism. I'm Drew Conry Murray. Greg Farrow is over in the UK.
Hey.
There's nothing
like
wrong
to think
with
of
that.
It as inspirational cynicism.
Inspirational. Informed, inspirational.
Yes, that's right. It should be cynicism that inspires you to understand and comprehend.
That's right.
You will through the eyes of snark.
You'll drive yourself to new heights of performance, understanding, and insight.
That's right. It's the journey not normally traveled.
Right. Oh, with that little bit of fluff out of the way, this episode of Network Break is brought to you in part by IT Pro TV, the resource to keep you and your IT team skills up to date. Visit itpro.tv/networkbreak and use the code NETWORKBREAK30. That'll get you a free 7-day trial and 30% off a monthly membership for the lifetime of your active subscription. This episode is also sponsored by ThousandEyes. ThousandEyes delivers visibility into every network your organization relies on, from your data center to the cloud. You can quickly and precisely pinpoint the root cause of network issues wherever they occur. Sign up for an account at ThousandEyes.com/packetpushers to monitor 3 locations for free and choose a ThousandEyes t-shirt. And speaking of ThousandEyes, please stay tuned at the end of this episode for a sponsored coffee talk conversation with ThousandEyes, and we're going to discuss monitoring Office 365. All right, let's get to the news. Cisco is acquiring Compute.io. This is a SaaS-based company that helps customers optimize their AWS costs.
Yeah, it's small acquisition, and I guess this is Cisco's grinding down towards the cloud. We saw Hewlett-Packard Enterprises, HPE, make a number of acquisitions in this space, and I think this is sort of the idea that what customers actually need help with is actually how to cost the public cloud. And I'm sure that they're asking their existing vendors, how do you price the public cloud, because we don't know how.
It's interesting to see Cisco moving into the space as sort of your cloud services broker, trying to add some value where they can. They've got the whole cloud center platform that Cisco's built out through acquisition and also some internal development. I thought they already had kind of a cost optimization and metrics package in there already, but maybe they found a way to add it out.
I think that this is one of these things where there was a bunch of startups a few years ago that were able to really focus on this and to produce something. You remember that, you know, this is this constant refrain that these big companies are not able to develop new products themselves. They don't have the research and development spending or the capability to do software very well. So it's much easier to let these other companies, you know, winnow out and then pick the winner, if you like.
Right.
But HPE bought, what was it, Cloud Cruiser or something like that?
Yeah, Cloud Cruiser. That sounds right.
So I think this is Cisco sort of playing catch up here. I think that Cisco's been trying to pretend that the private cloud is where it's all going to be and nobody's going to be in the public cloud. And then all of a sudden this week, I published an article in the Human Infrastructure magazine about Kip Compton, who is the vice president in the enterprise business unit, in the cloud business unit, saying that we now realize that all of our customers are going to be in the public cloud as well as the private cloud. So we're moving quickly to add value to that situation, et cetera, et cetera. And I actually struggle with that a little bit. I think a big part of what Kip was trying to make in that point was Cisco thinks that things might be developed in the public cloud, but then they'll be ported to the private cloud for deployment. And you can do that, but only if you can make certain justifications. Like, you know, 20 years of enterprise IT cynically makes me say that once something's done, it's done and nobody ain't moving it.
You mean if it's developed to the public cloud, that's where it's going to stay, and this idea of bringing it back on premises just doesn't make sense?
I think, you know, there's a difference between in theory, yes, that's a great idea, and in practice, that never happens. It's the old story about a project. The first 80% of the project takes 80% of the resources, and the last 20% takes the other 80% of the resources.
Sure. Yes.
And so if you've got it running in the public cloud, you know it's going to happen. People are going to say, well, let's find our way to keep it running in the public cloud because that'll be cheaper than porting it back to the private cloud, unless they've got some very specific, you know, there'll be a few, but I would suspect that the reality is they'll just find out ways to make it run in the public cloud because bringing it back to the private cloud is going to be very difficult. Especially one of the things we talked about a lot in the last year is just how hard it is to build a private cloud compared to the public cloud. Well, if you want to make the public cloud look less attractive, you have to show how expensive it is. So you go and buy a company that does pricing and give you a fair bit of, you know, whatever. And so I think that this is part of the sales process to say, look, are you sure you're aware of how much the public cloud's going to cost you? You know, it's going to cost you more than your private cloud, especially if you've already got your own data center, you've got the generators, you've got the building, you've got the cooling and all that sort of stuff. Why are you moving into the public cloud and paying? I saw something last week saying it's 6 times more expensive to be in the public cloud. And it's all about how you know, those numbers can be easily lied. So I would say this is just a straight out sales tool. Mr. Customer, do you realize how expensive the public cloud is going to be? Here's our tool that does that. That would be number one. And then the number two part, of course, is it needs to round out a hybrid cloud portfolio where if you're going to manage Google resources, because Cisco signed up a deal with Google Compute, we talked about that last week, And they want to be able to say to customers, well, this is how much it costs in Google. This is how much it'll be in private cloud. Why don't you deploy it wherever it makes financial sense to do so? And as part of our Cisco value add, the software that we lay over the top, their cloud or thing that's still coming together, we can now price that for you into our thing and help you understand the cost. And that puts them, you know, in front of the CIO, the salespeople and the Cisco sales reps start to look well informed and like they know what's going on.
Okay, so there's some of that informed cynicism we were talking about at the introduction. I'm going to take a slightly less cynical view. If you're saying part of Cisco's strategy here is to be able to, in some ways, frighten folks away from the public cloud, I think there's actually a legitimate market for this kind of capability because, as we saw with Amazon rolling out so many services at reInvent, the cloud is getting a lot more complex. The pricing is getting a lot more complex. There's a Datanauts episode where the Datanauts talk to somebody who has built a consulting business out of helping people understand their Amazon bill, right? Just the billing. So having a company that actually, there's multiple companies out there that do this, that sort of spot some arbitrage difference. Like if you move from instance X to instance Y, it's going to save you X amount per whatever unit. And if the cloud is really that flexible, then yes, there's some money to be saved here by being able to take advantage of that flexibility and mobility, moving your workloads around too, and also right-sizing the instances that you're using. So I do think there's a legitimate business case for this and Cisco seeing an opportunity here.
Yeah, but we have those same things today in enterprise IT. It's called the network architect or the network designer who works out how much it's going to cost to buy a given solution from vendor X, right? So that role is just going to change to being, how much do I buy from Amazon and what is the right thing to buy from Amazon or Google or Azure? I mean, the role of most network architects and network engineers is to waste hundreds and hundreds of hours deciding what to buy and how much it will cost.
So you're going to take that ability to waste all of that time into the cloud with you. Is that what you're saying?
Well, the steak dinners have to come from somewhere.
That's right. Steak dinners don't pay for themselves.
That's right. That's inspirational right there. So, you know, I think this is kind of, you know, there's a lot of things that you can do. As always, an acquisition is very rarely just for one thing. You know, occasionally it's just for headcount. But this, I think, is one of these things where Cisco needs to have a better strategy to help customers so you can sell this product directly to customers, like understand your pricing. But I do very much think this is a secondary issue of the public cloud is quite expensive, but you have to demonstrate it to customers. You have to have a tool that will actually capture that and then show to customers why they should be buying more UCS servers, more Nexus switches, more ACI licenses, because it's cheaper than going to the public cloud.
Okay, interesting tact. All right, just to round this out, Cisco did not disclose the acquisition price for what it paid for compute. And right now, compute is only for AWS, but presumably Cisco plans to expand that across the other two platforms, the big ones, Azure and Google.
Just add money.
That's all it takes. Okay, moving on. Juniper Networks has announced a trio of new applications, which the company is calling bots. The idea is to encourage customers to embrace automation. So these are supposedly lightweight, easy-to-use applications. Roll up, give the customer an easy win with one of them, get them more comfortable with automation, and it sort of ties into Juniper's whole self-driving networking strategy.
Yeah, I imagine this is going to be a bit difficult for Juniper to swallow the fact that they've made this Contrail, you know, this SDN product, and it's supposed to be amazing and great, and now they're starting to have to build software on top of it, which is not something that Juniper has historically wanted to do. So I sort of strikes me as the fact that, you know, they're struggling to get Contrail into the market, and so now they're starting to put apps on top of Contrail to show customers exactly what you could do if only you had an SDN network, right?
Mm-hmm.
What I do also think is that I'm looking at these bots and actually they just look like scripts that a bunch of engineers might have written for customers, probably in their consulting division.
One of the bots, definitely the Contrail test bot, which validates pre-production network configuration changes, that did come out of their services unit and it is using scripts and applications that they've built for consulting gigs. Yeah, so it's kind of productizing their consulting business.
Yeah. So you do see this occasionally where an internal project inside the customer gets sort of boosted into a pseudo open source status where it seems like, oh, that's really useful. And then a few more customers go, oh, we could really make use of that. And then all of a sudden they go like, hey, customers want that. We'll turn that into a product. And in this case, I sort of see this as a, we've got Contrail. Customers are struggling to know how to use it. So what we'll do is put these bots on top and give them a way to sort of demonstrate the value. And really, this is the sort of thing that customers have been doing themselves, writing their own scripts to automate the SDN that sits underneath, right? And just packaging them up like this is a bit of a sales pitch. So, you know, it's sort of like if you had SDN, you could do these cool things. Let's demo Peerbot. It's like, oh, okay, but I could have written a script for that in a few weeks, really, for most people.
Yeah, that's true. So let me just run down the other two bots we mentioned, Testbot. The others are Contrail Peerbot. This automates all aspects of your BGP peering, including adding, modifying, and removing peering points. And then there's the AppFormix HealthBot, which monitors the health of the network and devices, gives you some nice little graphs, and supposedly has some machine learning behind it to do analytics.
Yeah. Well, we should note that this week that there's almost nothing to talk about.
So that's why we're talking about bots.
Yeah, that's right. And this is the second week of December. We're nearly into the holiday season. There really isn't a lot of press release. So if you're wondering why I'm cynical about these things, there's not a lot of big news to talk about. And today's show might just be a little shorter than normal. And that'll be why, because if there's nothing to talk about, we're not talking about it.
All right. Well, we'll leave the bot story there. We'll have links if you want more details in the show notes.
It's a good thing. I mean, this is great, but it doesn't look to me like it's strategic, or I don't want to overblow this and say, you know, this is amazing. You know, we've seen plenty of app stores and 20 of vendors make these little tiny apps that do really useful things, but they're all spawned out of professional services projects that sort of got out of hand. Look at Cisco's Intercloud. Do you remember that one 4 or 5 years ago? Cisco was going to be an AWS competitor with Intercloud, and it was really just a project with Telstra in Australia. And Cisco thought, we can replicate that with lots of other customers. Well, lots of press releases in the Intercloud, and then all of a sudden, like, oh, actually, that wasn't such a great idea.
That's right, yes. Well, yeah, I mean, the history of technology is littered with grand ambitions and big failures. But
it's littered with failures, a lot of them.
Yes. I take Juniper's position that there's a lot of talk about automation. It can be very difficult to get your hands around it. So I sort of like the idea that they're trying to bring, you know, an easy win into a customer environment with this. And if it works, great. And we'll see what happens. Just quick to note that they're not actually going to be shipping until mid 2018. So this is still a work in progress.
Yeah, right. See, so I just, you know, this idea of bot is all very, you know, fancy modern language. And this just sounds a bit overblown for some scripts that were really popular amongst the pre-sales team or the project teams. And they've packaged them up to see if they could help sell more products. That's what I see it as.
It's the power of marketing.
Yeah, it's fine. It's a good idea, especially if customers want that.
Yeah,
customers want it. I just don't want to get all excited about a bot on a network. Right. Because
noted, duly noted. All right, on with the next story. Barefoot Networks, we've talked about them before. They make the programmable Tofino networking silicon. They have released a software application. They're calling it Deep Insight. If you've got Tofino-based switches, you can use Deep Insight to monitor the network packet by packet.
Ever since Barefoot was announced, we've talked a lot about this programmable silicon and the ability to do stuff here. And this is the use case that Barefoot came out with at launch, saying, you know, you could write an app that could do this, you know. And clearly nobody has written that app, so now Barefoot's written it themselves.
Right. It's based on why not, right? They know what they're doing. And well,
because they would have thought somebody else would have done it. If they could, if somebody else had done it, I bet you they wouldn't be, because they wouldn't have spent their startup dollars doing it.
Well, maybe not, but it makes sense to me, because trying to get your head around what you're going to do with this fast programmable switch, why not have a suite of apps to take advantage of it?
Yeah, well, I just sort of thought, you know, if I'm AWS or Azure and this is the product that I'm using, I am going to write my own app, because it's going to have to integrate into my own platform. So maybe this signals that Barefoot is trying to get out, you know, to expand its footprint into, well, the enterprise or the mid-tier cloud market and say, you know, this is every packet in the network. Or maybe it's to sort of say, to get more awareness of this per packet inspection engines. You know, normally we've seen companies like ExtraHop and those types of people doing this, people like Gigamon feeding data into those appliances and all that sort of stuff, and really requiring something unique. And Barefoot's trying to change that a little bit by saying, why don't you just put it into the ASIC? And maybe the only way they can get people's attention is to actually say, well, we've developed this app. You should look at that.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if some of their customers who are actually using this have developed an app and they're rolling out sort of an app. And because it's built on the P4 programming language, so that means you can take the app, you can decide what metadata you want to pull out of the system to analyze. All this information gets fed into a server you run on your premises. So it's entirely possible they have customers who have done something like this, but they're saying, we'll give you sort of a template. You can, you know, use it out of the box or change it to fit your own needs. But again, we've got this cool stuff and we're now having to write applications to show you just how cool it is.
And it is very cool. Like this idea of being able to tag packets at source and then trace them across a very large ECMP spine. So if you've got a, you know, it's getting common for sites to have 5,000 ports and you've got a 6-way or an 8-way or a 12-way ECMP spine, which switch is playing up? The only way to know, you know, whether there's buffer spikes in one of those 12 switches or 36 at the leaf node or whatever it is, this is the sort of app that'll actually tell you that real-time telemetry without actually trying to just poll it to death. So one of the other problems with a lot of devices is if you try and poll the buffer, you know, pull statistics out of the boxes or stream telemetry off them, you actually kill the box at high speed. So
right.
This is actually a way of just saying, leave the box, don't plop it, don't play with the software on the switch, just leave it alone and just use cheap software on cheap switches and then use this tagging to give you the data that you want. So don't do it in the network, do it over the network, which is actually an interesting And certainly scales better than the alternatives of streaming telemetry out of the appliances themselves.
We did some coverage on this, Ethan Banks and I, over at Packet Pushers. We'll have links in the show notes if you want to get more details. But in the meantime, it is time to take a little break and tell you about one of our sponsors, that is IT Pro TV. And Greg, you can tell us about them.
Sure. This episode is brought to you by IT Pro TV, and who want to polish your skills and help you to advance your career with over 2,000 hours of on-demand training and continuing to add more than 125 hours. The individual membership will help you prepare for lots of certifications that you might care about, CISSP, CISM, CISA, and Certified Ethical Hacker. You know, they have a training course library that includes more than that across Cisco, CompTIA, Microsoft, VMware, and so forth. And this can help you get yourself ready for cybersecurity threats as well, because IT Pro TV has a team solution. With this group pricing, you should be able to go over to your CIO and say, here's a supervisor portal, and he can see all the people who are doing their team's training schedule. So if you've got 10 people in your IT team, you can get a group subscription, and then the CIO can see who's doing the training and who's not. So if everybody's whining about, I want to spend money on training, if they're not doing it in IT Pro TV, they obviously weren't serious about it. You'll find that a lot. A lot of people say they want training, but when they're given a chance, they don't act, what they're actually saying is, I don't want to do the work, it's too hard. It's not that I've ever seen that happening. Just hypothetically, you know what I mean?
Sure, sure.
So you can stream ITPro.tv courses live and on demand worldwide via a wide range of appliances, Fire TV, Apple TV, PC, or you can even watch them on your favorite smartphone in your approved location. So you go over to ITPro.tv, ITPro.tv/networkbreak, and use the code networkbreak30 to try it free for 7 days. And you'll receive 30% off your monthly membership for the lifetime of your active subscription. That's itpro.tv/networkbreak and use the code networkbreak30. You can find this in the show notes if you want to find it later on. And so, and learn more about their team solution and sign up for a free demo of their supervisor portal. Don't forget to go over there and check it out. It's not bad, actually.
Thanks, IT Pro TV.
So I want to jump over here. I got a briefing 3 or 4 weeks ago about VMware Cloud Foundation 2.3 release, right? So VMware keeps working towards building a private cloud stack. You know, normally VMware is like this Lego blocks, or more like breeze blocks, you know, big fat hairy bricks that you put together, and mostly it's up to you to make them all work together. And VMware is steadily working towards the realization that, you know, companies like Nutanix and Cisco are building private cloud solutions that are actually sort of integrated. You know, this idea of vSAN and NSX combined with vSphere and a bunch of other products could actually be just a turnkey private cloud. And so Cloud Foundation 2.3 steps up towards that direction. Now, pretty amusing, really, because VMware is really starting to sort of put it together. But one of the things I noticed in this deck, and I wish I could show you the slide, was that they finally realized that actually deploying the software-defined data center is actually enormously complicated. So today, it built 10 products. And in VMware Cloud Foundation 2.3, all 10 of them can be deployed just click and point. So it's an orchestrated or an automated deployment. Unfortunately, only 7 of the 10 have automated patching. You sort of got this private cloud made up of 10 parts that you have to sort of quasi-assemble yourself. And when they're ready to be patched, half of them will patch themselves, but the other ones have to be patched manually. Bit messy.
A bit messy, yes.
Yeah. So it's almost like, you know, quick deployment and simple patching and, you know, client usability wasn't actually part of the development process. You think? You know?
And here's, you know, where a company like Nutanix or maybe Cisco is trying to exploit, we've got this all integrated together already.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, it just seems, I've had a number of people say to me the SDDC from VMware is impossibly difficult to get going. And, you know, guess what? That's what they're working towards. Of course, there's a bunch of other things in here, support for Skylake, Pearly, Intel x86 CPUs, and interesting support for certain models of register switches. So what they're actually heading towards is the SDDC will actually orchestrate the physical switches as well. That reinforces the point I've been making for about 18 months now, which is the switches that go in the top of your SDDC are not the switches you choose. They'll be defined for you by the private cloud operating system that you choose. So, you know, as they work towards this private cloud as a turnkey experience, as they say in the things, I just sit there and got to the end of it and went like, it seems really obvious that you want a turnkey experience. Why hasn't this been done already?
It's been a long, long journey to the private cloud.
Yeah, I just can't shake the feeling that it must be more profitable to sell it in pieces and let people self-assemble and get the hell out. You're like,
well, sure, because then you can offer them professional services.
Well, maybe you can just charge more for licenses if you have, instead of integrating all 10 into one license, you sell 10 different parts.
That's
the sum of the parts is greater than the whole.
That's
sort of thing.
That's right. Synergy.
And I'm sure that, you know, the internal politics inside big companies, as I've always pointed out, big companies are inherently stupid because there's multiple business units all fighting with each other. They find it very difficult to communicate and to unify. That's just the way of big things, right? Big projects are always like that. It's not a criticism. It's just an observation. And it just seems like, you know, if I was building VMware on AWS, I'd really want this automated deployment to be working. And it's not. Because
yes.
They're still building it into the product today. This really seems like, you know, these legacy vendors really haven't got their stuff together. And this is why, you know, AWS is really able to make ground on these people. They need to hustle up here.
Absolutely. I mean, I feel like I've been reporting on the private cloud for 7, 8, 9 years now, and still the same promises at the outset haven't quite been fulfilled yet. One of the reasons, I think, again, why hyperconverged is starting to make inroads, because it's actually starting to deliver on that sort of ease of deployment, ease of use. It's all software enabled and integrated out of the box. And yeah, and VMware, we should note, isn't the only one who's struggled with this.
Well, yeah. And that's why a $2 billion startup called Nutanix got into the market.
That's right.
It's doing exactly that.
Yes.
Amazing.
All right. All right, moving on. There's a new study that came out, Carrier Spending on Network Functions Virtualization, otherwise known as NFV. It's predicted to reach $37 billion by the year 2021. That's a compound annual growth rate of 30%. That's according to the research firm IHS, as being reported by SDX Central.
There's nothing like a big number to be reported by somebody.
Sure, we gotta tell you numbers. Numbers, numbers, numbers.
A lot of people tell me that this idea of running firewalls in VMs is not a good idea and blah, blah, blah. But the simple reality is that's what everybody's heading to. I think this number is somewhat laughable. 37 billion in 4 years' time seems, you know, pretty strange to me. I don't think the take-up will be that fast. And I certainly don't think carriers are going to spend money on NFV. I think they're going to turn to open source for a lot of this. You know, what's the value in spending high prices on software only, that when I can fracture those, like the value of existing firewall companies is that they can run reliably at very high performance on custom hardware. But if I can just run it in a VM, and if I can run 1,000 VMs instead of 10 physical units, then I don't have the reliability or the scalability problems that I used to have.
Right, right.
I actually think the NFV market is probably largely destructive to revenues, and I suspect this $37 billion might be really based on legacy concepts of how much money is on the table to be made.
That's possible. They tried to break out where they think some of this money is going to go. And obviously a big chunk of it is going to go into software companies who are selling virtualized services. The hardware folks are going to get a very tiny piece of this.
Like I said, don't think it's going to happen. That's a lot of money. But I think I would say that a lot of that money is just going to blow up into open source and disappear out of the market completely.
And we've reported on this quite a bit. There are big carriers like AT&T, Deutsche Telekom, even Huawei, doubling down, tripling down on open source projects coming out of the Linux Foundation. Cord, Onos, ONAP, all of that. So yeah, I think that's a pretty good prediction.
Yeah, I'd be much more confident that that's where carriers are heading. They're not going to rush off and buy their favorite. That's not to say all of them aren't. You know, there's still carriers all around the world, but I don't think it's a $37 billion market.
All right. Well, maybe we can put that on the prediction sheet.
Yeah, maybe not.
All right. You found a story about Apple apparently having to pay some back taxes to the European Union.
So there's two things here. I've said a few times that the fact that technology companies don't pay taxes is giving them an unreasonable competitive advantage compared to old companies, and also the fact that they're actually taking money out of economies for their own benefit. Now, the EU has sort of taken this to the extremes and actually forced the Irish government to take $15 billion in taxes from Apple. Previously, the Irish government actually gave Apple a tax holiday for setting up there, and the EU has now forced Ireland to charge that tax, so now Apple has to pay up. Now, this is happening against the background of the US government and the tax bill that's been happening. The current president has been forcing a very preferential tax bill for well-funded companies. Instead of paying 35% tax to repatriate into the US, they're talking about a 10% tax holiday. They will not be pleased that the EU is chasing them down for unpaid taxes or unexpected taxes on cash that happens to be sitting in EU banks just as they're about to get it home. So I just thought, and they will not be pleased if they are being forced to hold several billion dollars in tax on the expectation that EU is going to hit them with taxes that haven't been levied because of sweetheart deals with regional governments. So just an interesting one, just something that we've talked about a few times. Keep in mind that every time a big technology company doesn't pay tax, that actually means local services like healthcare and roads and police don't get serviced. And that's something that needs to be fixed.
That's right. All right. Moving on to our other sponsor for today, ThousandEyes. As your network expands to include cloud services, ISPs, and third-party providers, your visibility diminishes. And that's a problem when you're running critical applications, websites, and services. ThousandEyes gives you that visibility back. They can see into every network your company relies on, the corporate network, the internet, the cloud service provider network, and you get it all in one place. They have cloud agents that are deployed in locations all across the globe and enterprise agents that provide additional visibility from within your own network. This vantage point provides the most complete understanding of your network topology, dependencies, and behavior. Using ThousandEyes, you can piece together multiple layers of network insight from BGP routing and DNS to the web server and layer 3 performance. You can quickly and precisely pinpoint the root cause of problems like device faults, congestion, and service provider outages. You can also share data and insights with your vendors and customers to help you resolve problems faster or point that finger more pointedly. And there's a special offer just for Packet Pushers. Sign up for a free account at ThousandEyes.com/Packet Pushers. You can choose a free ThousandEyes t-shirt. Start seeing your network like you've never seen it before. ThousandEyes, it's network intelligence you can see.
Excellent stuff.
All right, back to the news. Dell Technologies reported its Q3 fiscal results. The company earned $19.6 billion in revenue and an operating loss of $533 million, which I think is pretty much tied to them having to pay back all of the debt they took out to make that acquisition with EMC happen.
Yeah, so they are up. So selling, weirdly, while everybody else, HPE, Cisco, IBM, are all saying that sales in servers, PCs, and notebooks is dying, Dell's doing just fine, up 8% over last year.
Yeah, that's from their client solutions, PCs, notebooks, and tablets. Yeah, they seem to be doing a pretty good business on the PC side, which other companies have walked away from.
I think it's one of the – remember what we talk about when companies merge and they get big? And, you know, it's either get big or go home.
Right.
And I think, boom, you know, they got big.
That was the strategy. Yep.
That was the strategy. You know, take out your competitors, and if you get bigger, your production volumes increase, so your cost of goods go down. You've got a competitive advantage, so you can increase your volume in a shrinking market.
On the infrastructure group, that's Dell EMC. Servers and networking inside that group brought in $3.9 billion. That's a 32% increase year over year. Their storage revenue was $3.7 billion. That's flat compared to the previous quarter.
Yeah, I'm not sure about that. That sounds unreasonable. I know that Dell's networking business seems to be doing quite strong. That's why they've never sponsored the show. I don't feel the need, basically, because they're doing quite well. But then they've got companies like Big Switch and, you know, doing all these partnerships because they've got that open hardware platform. They can let other people go and do the selling for them. And I think that's the same thing with the server business. They're being quite smart in saying, we'll do business with everybody. And it's actually working for them. It doesn't always work, but I think for Dell, it certainly is.
And a quick note, I saw this at the very bottom of the press release about the financial results. Because Dell Technologies is built up of a whole bunch of different companies, including EMC, VMware, and a few others. This quote says, other businesses consist of RSA, Information Security, SecureWorks, Pivotal, and Boomi, and do not constitute a reportable segment because they are not material to the company's overall results. I thought, ooh, that means they're not making a lot of money there.
Well, Pivotal is about a $300 million, $400 million company. It's a really unusual business in that when you buy a Pivotal product, you get told exactly how to use it. And you're not like you have to be pair programming and you have to be on their and you have to do this and you have to buy a services package from them and you can't do it any other way. So it's really quite a niche market. It's very profitable because professional services comes with the product, but not necessarily going to be a huge thing after all. And increasingly, we're seeing DevOps kind of bypass Pivotal in some way.
Yeah, but an RSA and SecureWorks, both security companies, very hot security market for them not to be having material results makes me wonder what's going on.
I both see both of those companies as very legacy in the security market. That is, they're sort of like a 10-year-old product market. They have 10-year-old models on security. I think their future generations of security look very different.
That could be.
So not surprising.
All right, our last story for this show. Last week when we were talking about all of the news that came out of AWS reInvent, we barely mentioned Alexa for Business. That's an effort by Amazon to expand their Alexa voice assistants, take it out of the home and bring it into the office. I found a story on Forbes that says this move is maybe generating some friction between Amazon and Microsoft because Amazon is launching an incursion into Microsoft's home ground, which is the enterprise and the business customer.
And Apple's home Siri and Cisco's attempts to do voice bots on its unified communications platform and Google's voice as well.
That's right.
All of those companies want to get into the business environment. The consumer market's certainly very good. And Amazon, of course, is pretty much doing very well, but I have no doubts that all of these other voice players want to be in the business market at some point. And really, this is the fat lady sitting down on the seat to make sure nobody sits next to her.
Obviously, Microsoft has Cortana. That's their own voice-activated assistant. They're making significant effort to try to tie that into Office applications and make it useful to have some voice-activated technology in the Office. But it seems to me like Amazon's using the Apple strategy where we win the consumer market and then leverage that to pry open the enterprise market, which is what they did with iPhones and Apple PCs and that whole, you know, BYOD movement. I think with Alexa, they're borrowing from that game plan. And also, essentially, maybe not being first mover, but being very quick to bring Alexa into the Office.
There's nothing wrong with that strategy. The consumer market is not as, you know, we'll take whatever it's given. And you don't often make a lot of money out of it except by doing it at scale, whereas the enterprise market gets a bit selective and has specific requirements, but it doesn't have the scale of the consumer market. So by doing the consumer market first, you actually use it as a place to iterate quickly, find out what works, and then you enter into the, you know, into the business market saying, we've got this proven product, it's ready to go, and now we have to start finding product fit.
And frankly, you get people comfortable with it and they want to use it. And so they bring it in on their own, even if they weren't allowed to by IT. And so we'll see this happening all over again with Alexa and voice activated assistants.
But it's going to get very messy because you're going to have people wanting to use Cortana because it's in Microsoft something something. You've got Cisco Unified Comms. So the telephones there are running Cisco's voice bots or whatever their play is around that. If you're running Google Docs, well, maybe you want to use Google Voice. You know,
it's going to get very messy. You're going to have like three assistants lined up on your desk and have to.
That's right. And all, most people have Apple iPhones because, you know, they work and they're secure and there's a Siri in there. Which one of these are you actually going to use? Yeah. So I don't think anybody's going to come out of that one alive. That sounds very OpenStack to me.
It's going to be a delightful mess. That's what I think. I, frankly, I can also see we're moving into an era where voice is going to be, if not the de facto, then certainly a key way to interact with machines. But in the open office environments that we have, having people shouting at their Alexas in cubicles all over also seems like a recipe for disaster and potentially embarrassment.
Well, yes, I agree. But, you know, this seems to be a challenge that everybody can't wait to have.
Embrace it. Embrace the chaos.
Probably because these companies are saying how awesome voice is going to be, but actually it's going to, I think it's going to be a pretty messy for a couple of years.
Oh,
as absolutely. Someone who fiddles around with Siri and a few others from time to time, I have a bunch of these, you know, voice systems that I use Siri to talk to my automated house, and it's, look at that, just went off.
That's right. Damn it, who turned off the lights again?
That's right. And so I do think it's going to be messy, and I don't think there's going to be any, and there's a lot of way to go forward. Like, it's just going to be messy. Done.
All right. Give us a lot to talk about. All right. That wraps it up for this episode. Greg, where can folks get more of your sparkling gems of wisdom?
I keep up a constant stream of inspirational cynicism on my Twitter feed as at EtheriumMind, and of course, blogging at Packet Pushers and doing my microblogging at EtheriumMind.com.
I think we got to get inspirational cynicism on a t-shirt or something.
Well, if people want to, yeah, we could think about that.
That's right. And I'm Drew Conry Murray. You can follow me on Twitter as @Drew_CM, and I blog at packetpushers.net. Thanks to our sponsors, IT Pro TV and Thousand Eyes, and please stay tuned for our Thousand Eyes Coffee Talk. That's coming right up. Welcome to Coffee Talk. Today, we're talking with Thousand Eyes, our sponsor for this segment, about monitoring performance and availability of Office 365. Our guests are Amit Naik and Alex Henthorne Iwane from Thousand Eyes. Alex, I'm going to start the conversation with you by asking why Office 365 customers need to monitor their connectivity.
Great to be here. Well, I think at the highest level, I guess Microsoft is obviously has a huge footprint in enterprises. It's considered by many companies to be their most strategic IT partner and vendor. And then looking at Office 365, this has really grown into a big line of business. It's 120 million monthly active users. It's growing at 42% annually. So a lot of businesses are moving to it. And it's supporting a lot of important functions. So you've got Exchange Online, obviously, for email and calendaring, collaboration with SharePoint Online, and then even things like CRM with Dynamics. So given the user footprint, it's a pretty top-of-mind set of applications for IT leaders, directors, and everybody else who's going to work on these projects. And a lot of organizations, it's one of the most important and visible cloud migration projects on their plate. So, but beyond the importance of the application, one of the things that's important to consider is the aspect of that when you move an app to the cloud, you're dealing with a new normal from an operations point of view. You don't own the app. You can't.
And you don't own the WAN either.
Right, exactly.
Which is key here because it goes over the internet. So the thing about Office 365 is it's not your data center, it's not your computers, it's not your internet connection. You don't know. There's no certainty in all of that. And so the only way that you can get certainty is to see it in some way.
Right. And the thing about that, it's interesting to think about it, is that the old way of doing monitoring was really based on passive monitoring. Right. So you collected a ton of data from the infrastructure and network pieces that you owned. But when a large portion of those networks are no longer owned by you, how do you do that? It's the issue, though, is that you still own the user experience. Ultimately, you still own the outcome. So you need to find a way to monitor for the end user experience and figure out how to fix things when performance degrades. You're still going to be on the hook. You're going to still feel the heat as a networking technologist, right, to fix those issues. So monitoring the performance and the user experience is just really important for that.
So what are the big challenges, the concerns that when customers come to you to talk about this, when they're considering this migration, what are their monitoring issues?
One of the first things that customers deal with is just understanding how it all works. Okay, so you've got this new normal, you've got all these networks that you don't own anymore. But also, Office 365 is not one thing. It's actually multiple applications. So, and those applications work differently. Now, Microsoft has done a nice job of pulling them all together under a common web portal and has a sort of a uniform look and feel. But under the hood, the apps are architected and delivered fairly differently. So, I mean, think about, you know, Exchange Online, SharePoint Online, OneDrive, OneNote, Skype for Business, Microsoft Dynamics. It's a whole suite. So each of those sessions for an application requires connectivity to several backend services, including, for example, an identity provider. So if your, you know, identity provider is on-premise, then you have one workflow, right, in terms of
going to the cloud. Yeah, when you say identity provider, you're actually talking about Active Directory. But it could be something else. It could be a third party, of course, but
right.
Most people would be using their internal Active Directory, yeah.
Right, so if it's on-premise, then you're going to go to the cloud, then back on-premise, and back out to the cloud, right, depending on what pieces are where. So it's not just a single session. So there's a number of different flows split across various services and going over different networks. And then you think about the difference, for example, between Exchange Online and SharePoint Online. So you could assume or make the mistake of assuming that because you've rolled out email successfully to the cloud that you can roll out SharePoint. But for example, email is synchronized and cached between various global data centers operated by Microsoft. But if you have a user in Australia, their experience with email will be generally fine because it's all distributed. But SharePoint always has one primary data center from where all the content is served. So if the customer chooses a U.S. region as their primary they're going to have some network issues to think about and baseline and all.
Now, that's really interesting. So what you're effectively saying there is that even though you might be using one as your Office 365 or one as your service, it might actually be spread across multiple data centers. As you said, SharePoint tends to come from one. Office 365 might come from two or three in your local region, perhaps, and you're not going to know. And so you're not even going to be able to use traditional monitoring based on IP addresses because it can move around.
Right. And it's just helpful to know, have some architectural orientation and then build a monitoring approach for each application that's actually somewhat different.
Because it occurs to me you're probably going to want to have, you know, for a Skype application, QoS or prioritizing that connection is going to be important. Whereas with email, if it's a half a second late, it's not going to really matter.
Exactly. And right. So a collaboration suite like SharePoint, people are really going to feel it if they're trying to work in a team across different regions. And,
right.
And you know, certain folks are always, you know, behind the curve.
That's a very, yeah, you know, or the budgeting cycle, perhaps. Maybe the budget's not there quite yet.
Right. Hey, we're not saying that you guys down in that region are second-class citizen, but, you know, you just might feel that way. Sorry.
Yeah. The budget will catch up with your need eventually.
All right, so let's bring Amit into the conversation here. Given the complexities that we've just talked about, what are the considerations, what are the recommendations for managing all of this?
Good question, Drew. So there's basically three areas from a consideration perspective that let's take a look at, right? The very first question you're going to get is around the network architecture and internet connectivity. So the, as you know, 365 is in the cloud. So the big question is, okay, how do you get to the cloud, right? Do you backhaul everything through kind of one or two or a few central exit points, or do you go direct to the internet, right? If you ask Microsoft, their standing recommendation for everybody is go direct to the internet. They want as little as possible between the user and their application, right? Because they know the kinds of problems some of traditional architectures can introduce into the equation, right? But so what do you do, right? So traditionally, enterprises have architected their WANs in a way that, you know, you have sort of perimeter security, right? You have a few really well-defined internet exit points, right? And that's okay, right? But you need to know before going in and as to, you know, what the penalty is from kind of backhauling everything to a few internet exit points, right? Like if you have offices down in Latin America, for example, do you really want to backhaul all of that traffic down to Miami or Los Angeles to exit out to Microsoft? Or maybe they've got a data center down there, right?
Yeah, that's a great point.
Yeah,
and again, it's this regionality that you've got to start taking into account that maybe you weren't before.
Exactly, right? And so, you know, so these are some of the decisions people have to make even before they roll something out like that. And the question is, do you really have the data? Do you really have the metrics to show you, you know, what your WAN performance is, you know, coming back from Latin America to Miami or Los Angeles versus, you know, going straight out to the internet, right?
And I think it's also important to understand that it's not just about outages either. It's also about brownouts or fadeouts, right? If all of a sudden the performance is slow, well, nothing's broken, so how can you fix it? And, you know, is that your local internet connection? Is it your local tail circuit? Or is it actually the internet backbone itself? Is it Azure? How do you know, right?
Yeah. I mean, that's a great point you raised there, right? Which is, this connection is actually transiting through across so many different network segments. How do you know when there's a brownout? Do I need to troubleshoot my Wi-Fi? Do I need to kind of call my ISP? Do I need to call Microsoft, right? Like, so how do you kind of begin to solve that problem?
How do you even start the decision tree to decide if it's your internet connection or it's your Wi-Fi link, right? You know, it could be any of those. And so you have to have something. Like, one of the biggest problems in, you know, this is why I'm quite fond of ThousandEyes generally, is that you give me a starting point, right? You give me visibility into what was previously invisible in the internet. And as we go more and more towards the internet, that's what it's about. So how do I plan a ThousandEyes deployment? How do I use your user experience?
Yeah, so ThousandEyes can kind of help you in a number of different ways, right? So we can, you know, even at the pre-deployment stage, before, as you're considering rolling out Office 365, there's a lot of a lot of metrics you can gather, not only from your network, from an end-user perspective, that'll help you understand, you know, what is a user experience going to be in a particular office, right? Like, what is the normal, right? What that gives you is a baseline for what you have to expect in the future, right? And it kind of establishes the baseline and also allows you to make better choices about, you know, do I split tunnel all my Microsoft traffic out the local internet exit point, or do I backhaul it across the network? And, you know, and gives you the data, the hard data, to make those decisions, right?
Yeah, and it's funny because when you think about baselining, what's so important about that is that when you enter this new normal of the cloud, people's expectations may be unrealistic. So if you don't have that baseline, you may be asked to restore service to a level that never existed in the first place.
So you want to be able to go back to the business and say, this is where we were, you know, before we even started. So that sort of sets expectations that IT can have some justification for why things are working the way they are. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, to a certain degree. I think you need to have a starting point for, one, your pre-deployment planning, but then also then, you know, that you have a picture for the operations piece to say, well, this is what normal is now. So, and hopefully that's a good normal, right?
Sure.
That you plan.
Hopefully.
Now, one of the other things you're talking about here is you're actually able to measure the impact of web gateways. So if people are running proxy servers or inspection engines or, you know, some sort of middle box, you're actually able to compare the performance with and without. How does that work? How would I do that? I'm interested in that.
So that's a really good point to think about, right? So traditionally, if you look at secure web gateways and proxies in the security stack, and the way it was architected really for, it was designed for a more static web, right? And it was designed for kind of the load imposed from that kind of a world. But now you have a very, very dynamic application like Office 365, where each browser tab may be making, you know, 50 connections back to the server, right? How is your proxy going to be able to cope with that? And you know, how is your firewall going to be able to cope with that? You're talking orders of magnitude increases in things like session tables and session counts, DNS lookups, etc. Right? So is your existing enterprise stack sized appropriately for a rollout like that? So what you do is you run measurements using ThousandEyes that go through the proxy and go direct to the internet and compare them, right? And that gives you a very good understanding of, you know, how much of an impact your existing stack is introducing into the equation.
You can go back to the manager and say, we need to modify our security policy because this is the impact of that. You know, you're mandating that it must run through my proxy server that's 10 years old and can't cope with the load. And I measured it, and here's how bad it is. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Either that or use the data to justify some new investments in the proxy infrastructure, right?
I think proxies, proxies date back to an era where the 80-20 rule applied, which was 80% of the traffic stayed inside and 20% went to the internet. And we're now seeing an inversion of that rule, where only 20% of the data stays inside the company and 80% goes out, literally to Office 365, to Azure, to Salesforce, to Dreamforce, to SAP. Even SAP and Oracle want to put their services online. And the idea of your security web gateways being a viable point of control and measurement, that boat's already sailed. And in 5 years' time, I doubt they'll be as valuable as they are today.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, all of this traffic is essentially SSL encrypted end-to-end, right? So it's not like the proxies have any visibility into what's actually going on through these applications.
Well, you can if you do some certificate magic, but you know, you can do some stuff. But I think from that point of view, but one other thing about ThousandEyes I just want to draw out, which is this idea of a dashboard. You build a dashboard of all this functionality so that I can have not a single pane of glass, because there's only one single pane of glass per vendor, but a single place to start your troubleshooting.
Exactly. You know, you can, within literally a matter of seconds, you can understand, you know, where you need to focus your attention, right?
And you've got alerting in there as well. It's not just I've got to go and poke it to get stuff. There's actually alerts that come out of that, because the world needs more alerts after all.
Exactly. We don't have enough alerts in our mailboxes, right? But yeah, I mean, so the question is, do you want to wait for your users to call in with complaints about slowness, or do you want to be proactively notified, right? That's really what it comes down to. So that you're ready with some answers when you realize there's an email outage in a particular office, and you know exactly what's causing it and what you need to do to resolve it, right?
And another thing that's kind of cool is to think about, because the dashboards that you can create with ThousandEyes are so usable. I was thinking about this recently, that they're more like an app experience. It's more like than a traditional tool in a lot of ways, because when you look at, let's say, a performance issue with Office 365 app, then you start drilling down, it's all contextualized for you. So I've been hearing customers saying that they're creating dashboards for their line of business client organizations and helping them to see, here's the applications you guys really care about, and here's now how to see whether there's a network issue underneath it. So now it's not a service ticket, is the network down, it's a self-service.
Which that's an interesting cool idea, because you sort of eliminate that knee-jerk fire off an email to IT because, hey, the network is down, when it may not be the network at all. They can actually look at a dashboard and get some more of a sense of what's actually happening.
And if you've got a competent user who's actually not just a mouth breather, but actually understands some basic computer principles, you can just give them their own dashboard and let them inform themselves.
Exactly. One of our customers was saying, I thought it was pretty funny, said, you know, if I, as the head of networks, don't know, you know, his pet peeve about getting calls, like, is the network down? He said, if I was the head of networks, don't know if the whole network is down, you're going to be calling me something else, the former head of networks, right? You know, so it's like, I'm going to give these guys dashboards and teach them to fish, because this is going to help everybody just move faster.
Yep.
And the other sort of key point is that even when you don't have very technical users, right, the complaints come in usually that start off, well, my SharePoint is slow, right? Well, what does slow really mean? It's such a subjective metric. How do you go from that to something quantifiable and something actionable, right, that you can actually fix or resolve? And the ThousandEyes endpoint agents are a great way to gather some of this data, right? So they can tell you right from the user's endpoint what their app experience is with some hard numbers. So there's no more subjective, my app, my email's slow, or my SharePoint is slow, right?
It's always good to have evidence on your side. So, Alex, do you want to wrap this up for us, this conversation?
Sure. So I think when we think about moving to the cloud, you're moving to a new normal. You've got a lot of the pieces that you're depending on to deliver app performance that you don't own anymore, but you still own the outcome. And that's one of the things that ThousandEyes is just so helpful with, is giving you the data to deal with that kind of new normal. So, we'd love folks to come visit ThousandEyes.com. We offer a free trial, so check that out. And, of course, if you need help, reach out. We're happy to talk more.
Awesome. Well, Alex and Amit, thank you for joining us. Thank you, ThousandEyes, for being a sponsor. And, of course, thank you, our listeners, for being here. You can find more fine, free technical podcasts at packetpushers.net. And while you're there, sign up for our free membership program. That will get you the weekly link propagation newsletter and the biweekly Human Infrastructure Magazine. For more details, head on over to packetpushers.net/members. And, as always, thanks for listening.